gentle man. Don't let them tell you that they have the plan, 'cause everyone's lost chin deep in the sand. And what they're trying to sell to you, you shouldn't be buying. Think for yourself, little girl.
Well, a very hearty welcome to a show called Thinking Clearly. This is Bob Frelick.
I'm Julia Minton.
And we're here for our 15th episode. Does it seem like that long, Julia?
It seems like just yesterday.
I know.
Frankly, I'm still getting over that giant chocolate birthday cake that was the size of a wedding cake. Three tiers and candles.
Oh, that was huge.
We almost set the whole studio on fire.
Anyone who saw it on our Facebook page knows what we're talking about. Go to our Facebook page. How do they get to our Facebook page?
Yeah, you can find us on Facebook, Thinking Clearly Radio. On KMed, we'll find our page.
And I'm so excited. We've got our podcast fully populated.
Yes.
It's amazing. And so this will be the 15th episode. There's 14 episodes on there now. You can go to thinkingclearly.libsyn.com. That'll be our webpage. You can review any of our previous shows on that, or we're on iTunes also. So
yeah, any of your podcast apps. I use Beyond Pod myself. You just go to add feed, you type in Thinking Clearly, and we will be there. You just subscribe to our podcast, and every new episode of every month will go right there into your little podcast program.
And so we encourage you to take a look at that, make comments, write a review for us on iTunes. That's really helpful. So we usually have a little bit more business for our show to do. But, you know, I am so excited about having this guest that we have, special guest, special to me, because several years ago, when I started thinking of this topic seriously, of critical thinking, I came across a website by someone whose name is Kevin De La Plante, and it's the Critical Thinker website. And I was amazed by the wonderful, well, at that time, these were kind of tutorials, I think, for a class that Dr. De La Plante taught at Iowa State University. So anyway, tonight we're going to go in depth about critical thinking with Kevin De La Plante. He's the creator of the Critical Thinker Academy, also the innovator and creator of something called the Argument Ninja Academy. We're going to find out more about that. We're going to talk about the importance of learning and practicing critical thinking, and hopefully get some resources and strategies for survival in today's information-intense environment. So I wanted to give a little introduction to Dr. Kevin De La Plante. He worked for about 20 years as an academic philosopher and teaching, and he was serving as the chair of the Department of Philosophy and Religious Studies at Iowa State University, but he left academia in, I believe it was 2015, to work full-time as an independent educator, speaker, and consultant, specializing in critical thinking skills. And his original tutorial courses, as I said before, the Critical Thinker Academy, have been great resources for a lot of topics we've covered on this show. And it's very exciting for us to have him as a Skype-in guest here tonight. So I want to welcome you to Thinking Clearly, Kevin De La Plante.
Thank you very much. Hi, Bob. Hi, Julia.
Hi, Kevin. Welcome.
It's a great pleasure to be here.
You know, on this show, Julia and I have discussed our ideas about what critical thinking is and why it's important. We've done that on a number of shows. But why don't you start out by giving your perspective on each of those, what critical thinking is and why it's important?
Sure. Actually, I've been watching some of the old or listening to some of the old shows, and I've been looking for where you start talking about the definitions that you have. And the list is getting longer, isn't it? Like, if you at one point it's a page. Is it longer than a page now?
I'm sorry, I was distracted.
Your sort of working definition of critical thinking.
Yes. I just added a fourth component to it.
Oh, yeah.
And I was going to send it to you to get your critique of it. I'll do that after the show.
Well, I'm curious. Which one is it?
What did I add to it?
Yeah.
I added to it, maybe it is on our Facebook page what I added, but I added the bit about effective critical thinking also requires a certain minimum amount of basic literacy in the content areas related to the issues we are examining and requires the willingness of to be a lifelong learner.
Yeah, good, good. Yeah, that would fall under the category that I call background knowledge, right?
Background knowledge. And this has just been born organically, because what I've found is that the kind of shows that we're doing mirrors that definition. The show's really kind of naturally led to the definition, and we've talked about science literacy, and I realized that I had left that out of the of the definition, so I put it back in.
It's one of the things that I did a podcast years ago. I did a podcast called the Critical Thinker Podcast.
Hang on just 1 second. Let me interrupt you just for a minute. We're going to do a station ID because I think we neglected
to
do that.
Hello. Listening to Redwood Community Radio, KMUD Garberville 91.1 FM and HD1, KMUE Eureka 88.1 FM and HD1, KLAI Laytonville 90.3 FM, and we're on the web at kmud.org. Also FM translator K25BQ out in Shelter Cove at 99.5. 65 degrees outside the studio.
Okay.
Thanks to our engineer Eric.
Engineer Eric. I mean, I would have done that. You'd think I'd know that by now, but, you know, I thought I would have to say Shelter Cove K258BQ, and I wasn't sure I could remember all those numbers.
He just cheated, by the way, listeners.
Okay. Go ahead, Kevin. Thanks.
Yeah, sure. So the old podcast that I did for about a year back in 2010, I did an episode called Critical Thinking's Dirty Little Secret or something like that. Mm-hmm. And it's the dirty secret of critical thinking education, which is that you can't really teach it in the sense that at least half of what you need to know to think critically about a given subject matter or an issue is, you know, comprised of background knowledge or subject matter knowledge about the issue. So if it's healthcare reform or what to think about Trump or, you know, whatever, then all the logic in the world can't make up for not knowing basic facts about the domains you're talking about, right? So, of course, you can't teach those. You can't teach subject matter expertise in a critical thinking class. So here I was teaching critical thinking in critical thinking classes at university for years. And, you know, it became clear to me that, you know, the stuff that I was teaching was the stuff that was teachable within a class. But the idea that's what constitutes the whole domain or all the essential skills that make up critical thinking skills was just false. It was obviously false. So I called it the dirty little secret. And what you just added there in your definition was essentially that dirty little secret. Anyways, my own approach to this question, I have, the more I taught this for years and years, and the more I realize that the definitions, when someone asks you like what critical thinking is, it sounds like it's asking for a definition, right? Mm-hmm. But I've never really found definitions of critical thinking all that helpful, either from a teaching standpoint or a learning standpoint. And the reason is because I've always thought that they're closer to a question like, it's like trying to answer what it means to be a good parent, like a definition of a good parent or a definition of a good writer or a good athlete or a good scientist, right? Is there anyone among us who could give a definition of a good parent in a way that captures all the ways that parents can be good or fail to be good? I can't, right?
Right.
But critical thinking is this normative concept where it's about thinking, which is a certain kind of activity, a mode of being in the world. And it's critical is the sort of normative part where you're saying it's like the good part in good parenting, right? It's like good thinking, right? Mm-hmm. So what you do, right, when you end up doing this is you end up making long lists of behaviors and attitudes and skills that keep growing and growing as you think about, you know, specific cases and examples. And once the list gets too long, it's no longer useful as a sort of short definition, right? Mm-hmm. It becomes an encyclopedia of things. And now, then you have the task of organizing those skills into categories and so on. So it no longer becomes it doesn't have the benefits of that the definitions, you know, give you normally. My own approach is that the skill set is so broad and diverse that that's the wrong way to tackle it. So I think what the more manageable question is to, it's more helpful to start by clarifying the goals of critical thinking. That's a much easier question to answer, I think. So once we have a better idea of what these goals are, then we can talk about ways of promoting those goals or things that interfere with those goals and so on. And that effectively becomes the subject matter, the domain of critical thinking. An example, another analogy for this approach is something like, you know, I don't know if I could give a useful definition of the field of medicine, but I think I have a good idea of what the goals of medicine are. Like you could agree on this, right? It's to, one is to relieve pain and suffering. Two, it's to promote health. Three, it's to prevent and cure disease. And maybe another one to care for those who can't be cured and so on. And so that once you have these goals laid out, then you know that anything that plays a role in promoting these goals or in inhibiting or undermining those goals can rightly be thought to belong to sort of the field of medicine, or it's relevant to medicine. And something like that, I think you can do with critical thinking. So if you focus on the goals part, then I think there's two categories of goals. There's general critical thinking goals, the sort of highest level types of goals. And then there are specific goals that are associated with specific critical thinking tasks or problems. So like a general goal would be like, I want to believe more true things and fewer false things, mm-hmm. right? Very general. A more specific goal might be something like, I want to become more aware of the biases in my own thinking, especially on political topics that get me really worked up, right? That could be a very specific goal. And then that could be a way of sort of narrowing the scope of the skills and other factors that are relevant to achieving that goal. So in terms of the general critical thinking goals at the broad level, I think there are these two categories of goals. I think there's one category that just falls under the bucket of we want to improve the quality of our thinking, right?
Mm-hmm.
The second bucket has to do something with like learning how to think for ourselves. That it's the notion of what's, you know, tied up with the notion of becoming an independent critical thinker. Like when I say I want my kids to learn to think for themselves, that notion, which is really about like autonomy and responsibility for our own beliefs, be able to be accountable for our own beliefs and decisions and so on. That's quite different from simply the idea of improving the quality of our thinking. So under that label, that heading of quality of our thinking, we can be a bit more specific. You can talk about the quality of our beliefs. We want our beliefs to correspond to the world. We want our beliefs to be, you know, calibrated to the evidence. We talk about the quality of our decisions. We want our decisions or choices to have better outcomes for us. We want our decisions to promote our true goals and values and so on. And then we can talk about the quality of our reasoning, you know, or more broadly, the process we use to form beliefs and make decisions. So that's where you get into this, the distinction between having good and bad reasons for belief or action, and the distinction between good and bad arguments, I think, falls into that category. So these two buckets, you know, improving the quality of our thinking and learning to think for ourselves, I think delimit, broadly speaking, the general goals of critical thinking. So anything that promotes these goals or interferes with those goals can rightly be called, you know, part of the domain of critical thinking.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one of the virtues of this approach is that it leaves open entirely the question of what sorts of factors can play a role in promoting or inhibiting these critical thinking goals, right? So, and that's something that you probably discovered as you've been gone through and trying to formulate a definition, right? Is that so many new kinds of factors show up. You've got thinking skills like logic and argumentation, right? Knowing how to distinguish good and bad arguments, that's got to be part of it. But also things like background knowledge, also things like attitudes and values, right? A certain kind of critical thinking spirit is a kind of attitude you have towards evidence and your own beliefs and so on. That becomes very diverse, right? This set of things. Well, this definition or this way of approaching it just leaves that category open. And in fact, it leaves it so open that you can talk about a lot of factors that often don't show up in the standard textbook definitions. For example, you can talk about, you know, features of people that are relevant to critical thinking, like your personal background knowledge, your cognitive skill, your communication skills, how much you know about probability, how much you know about fallacies and so on, your attitudes and values, your habits of thought, your thinking strategies and so on. But there's also this other category of features of the environment in which human beings live that's also relevant, like having access to the knowledge that's distributed in social networks or distributed across the culture. You had Stephen Sloman on, right?
I did.
Yeah, Stephen Sloman's whole thesis, right, is really relevant to mm-hmm. to what we're talking about here. There's also this feature of the environment where, you know, modifying your environment to make it easier to promote your critical thinking goals is something that can be done as part of a strategy. That's the whole category of what's known as nudges. Have you done anything on the show about
behavioral economics and nudges? We haven't talked. Sloman talks about that in his book, but we didn't actually get to that.
Yeah. Yeah, it's powerful. It's, you know, it can be really hard. I mean, we're really not very good critical. I mean, our reasoning skills are so limited individually, but together in groups, our reasoning skills are very powerful.
Or to build systems that will nudge us in the right direction. He was talking about the default, like, for example, being to be a organ donor. If you make the default that you would be willing to be an organ donor rather than to do something to opt in to being an organ donor, then people who naturally endorse the idea of being an organ donor would be more apt to make that. That's what he was. That's an example of a nudge, right?
Yeah, yeah, and other simple things like, you know, if you want to get people to eat fewer sweets at the lunch counter, if you put the desserts below the eye line, people right. will take more. Take less.
Well, marketing experts yeah. know how to nudge us in the right direction.
That's right.
In their desired direction. Let me just say one thing, and then we'll get to a couple other questions. I do want to say that this is a call-in show, but we will not be taking calls until 7:45. So.
Okay.
I think already had some folks that were anxiously anticipating opening the line. So, but about 7:45, there's a lot to cover. And could you cover just very briefly?
Well, I'm going to throw in real quick since we were talking about our podcast at the top of the show. For folks who do want to check out that show with Professor Stephen Sloman,
right.
That was episode number 14.
Right.
Just last month. So go ahead and catch that on our podcast for folks that want to catch up.
Great. Thanks, Julia. So I'm going to throw this at you, the second part of that question, to do as fast as you can. Just your take on why is it important, why is it crucial at this juncture in time to do this process of critical thinking? You elaborated some of what's involved, and it's going to sound so complex to people. So, you know, you do this and this and this and this. There's so much to it. Why should people be motivated to do that?
Well, I mean, it's... there's so many levels at which this is important, frankly. So I have a scheme where whenever I think about the question, I think about starting with the individual and sort of, you know, benefits to individuals and then spiraling outward. So first one, self-defense. As a kind of self-defense against efforts by media and other sources, whatever, to persuade or manipulate us by giving us false information or other kinds of nudging and manipulation, having some critical thinking skills can defend us against that kind of exploitation, actually. Then there's this notion of having, you know, the value of freedom of thought, the value of rational agency, of being able to say that the beliefs that I have, that I care about, are ones that I've thought about, that I've critically examined, and I can say that I own those beliefs, that they're mine, and that I'm not just parroting or echoing the upbringing that I might have from my family, the media, my peers and so on, the government, the church, whatnot. So that notion of freedom of thought and ownership of your own beliefs, I think, is a value that many people hold. Then there's this sort of category of personal empowerment, where the skill set actually allows you to be a more effective advocate for the beliefs and issues that you care about. And also it builds up your communication skills, for example. So it's effective in the workplace. It's effective in school. So all, you know, that whole category of personal empowerment is, I think, a real thing. And then scaling up. I think it's important for healthy democracies, for democratic citizenship. I mean, our system of government, if we care about it, if we defend it, but liberal democratic cultures depend on citizens taking some of the role of critical deliberation about issues and so on. It doesn't work properly unless there's a certain critical mass of people who are willing to take on that responsibility. And then finally, critical thinking is connected to argumentation, which is the primary method of sort of philosophical reasoning that goes back to the Greeks. So if you're interested in the whole category of pursuing philosophical wisdom, you know, broadly defined, the skill set is the tool set. It is what, you know, argumentation is to philosophy, what mathematics is to physics. Right. So, mm-hmm. So altogether, and then I think at this juncture, we have, you know, the sort of era, the strange era we're in right now, sort of the post-truth political era.
Yeah, definitely.
Facts don't matter anymore. Facts and logic don't matter. So I think we're in this moment, this particular historical moment where our environment, the political environment, the media environment, our social environment has become, frankly, increasingly hostile to critical thinking. That is, it's obstructive in a way that is and parts of it I think are engineered to undermine mm-hmm. our ability to think critically. So I mean, the fact is, and you guys have talked about this on your show, we have to acknowledge two realities here. One is that our ordinary human psychology is prone to error in this myriad of ways, and it's vulnerable to a host of persuasion techniques that can bypass our conscious rational deliberation, right? And the second one is that we live our lives now in what I like to call a persuasion matrix, which is where all the sort of persuasion, the persuasive messaging that comes at us from all sides, from all sources, is we now are, you know, bombarded by this, you know, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week through smartphones and so on. And much of this is engineered by third parties to exploit these very vulnerabilities in human psychology, that is, to bypass conscious rational deliberation, right? So these two things together create an extremely hostile environment for critical thinking. And this is more so than it has been in the past. It's gotten worse over the past few decades, and I think that this makes this material more timely and important than ever before.
Yeah, absolutely. Covered a lot of ground there. That was all very relevant. We already kind of mentioned marketing manipulation, and I often joke about how Facebook's a major employer of most social scientists these days.
Right.
So I really, you know, we've talked before about, you know, that sort of self-defense. Can you, the need for that in today's era, can you run through what some of your current offerings are in your courses and podcasts and what you've been developing in your second career here as an independent critical thinking teacher?
Oh, sure, sure.
To help empower people so they too can be a good defensive as well as a critical thinkers in what they do?
So I think there's like three parts to this answer. I'm sorry if these are longer, but I have...
No, I love it. You go into such detail. It's great.
My thinking about critical thinking has evolved. Or, you know, when I do this full time now, it's like my job, you know, and all of a sudden you think about these things in a different way when it's your job and not just something you teach one course for. Anyways, So the Critical Thinker Academy is this video tutorial site that I put together while I was still an academic. And it basically has video tutorial courses that I produced while I was teaching a number of courses. I was teaching logic and critical thinking. I was teaching philosophy, and so on. And over the years of teaching that, teaching various different types of topics within those courses, out of some standard textbook material, frankly, I developed courses on, you know, what is a good argument, basic concepts in logic and argumentation, formal fallacies, informal fallacies, and so on. That's what, and then I would do often the stuff I was doing on scientific reasoning. I would have to talk about probability theory and statistical reasoning and critical thinking about that, sort of fallacies about reasoning and this about chance and uncertainty. So I've got a number of courses on that as well. And I also have a course on cognitive biases that's more recent, because that material has now become much more relevant to what we're doing. So the psychology of belief and judgment and all the ways in which we're prone to error. There's a course on that. I also have some ad hoc courses on different smaller different topics. But the other main category is I have some courses on argumentative essay writing, which were designed for students because I was always, you know, grading a lot of essays over... 20 years, and always saying the same things about essay structure and so on. But it always struck me that there was an important connection between critical thinking and critical reading and writing. That is, the ability to write argumentatively mm-hmm. is a kind of skill that develops a certain kind of critical thinking ability that there's no other way to achieve that skill, right? Mm-hmm. So I see that as part of developing a skill set. If you can learn to read and write argumentatively, that helps the way you think, helps the way you speak, and so on. So all that stuff is there, and it's run as a sort of pay what you can afford model. So for as low as like $3 a month, you can access all this stuff, but the support levels go up from there. And there are people who pay at a much higher level because they support what I'm doing and support access for, you know, for this material to people who otherwise wouldn't be able to, and to keep me, and you know, paying the bills.
Yeah, that's great. I love the sliding scale model. It's very much what we're about here at KMUD, being community radio.
Right.
I also have to ask, I myself was a religious studies major, and Bob and I, Justin, it's been less than 2 years now, have gotten it together to do a monthly radio show about critical thinking, something really important to us both. I kind of have to ask you, from what I know of your background, you were a tenured professor at Iowa State University, and you gave up that prestige, that security of a tenure track to venture into this full-time independent critical thinking teacher.
Retirement.
I just have to say, from my point of view, you know, it's tenure tracks kind of, you know, the only payable wage there, the livable wage there is.
They are not easy to get.
I'm just really curious where you found your personal courage to step out of that academic track, and your motivation, because I imagine that, you know, you chose a track that I can only imagine must be the stuff that gets you out of bed in the morning and to take this path into being independent. I'd just like to hear a little bit more about where you gathered that from, what motivated you, and what keeps you going today.
Sure. Okay. Well, yeah, it is an unusual thing to do. There's lots of people who drop out of academia, but they usually do so at the rank of either as graduate students or as the rank of adjunct lecturers who aren't able to get a tenure track job or haven't been able to be for a while. But when you've been in the job for as long as I was, it's very rare to leave, right? So, but here's the secret, that, you know, I didn't share that widely with people, but the fact is, from the very beginning, I always intended to leave academia at some point. As an undergrad, when I started graduate school, I started with the intention of eventually leaving to pursue a career in public education. So, in fact, I had the idea in my head when I started my undergraduate degree, which was in physics. So when you go back a little bit earlier, my inspiration here was Carl Sagan. So I was a 13-year-old watching Cosmos, the original series in 1980, when that came on. And I was a bit of a science geek, I was a space geek, but I was captivated by this show and this astronomer, this charismatic astronomer, right, who was talking about these big questions, not just about astronomy, but about science and evolution and life and consciousness and how the brain works and so on. And I just thought that was fantastic. He was using this platform, which at that time was television, right, and film, to share this content with the public. So I thought that's what I wanted to do, or something like that, something in that ballpark. So to do that, I thought, well, I need to have some skill sets, right? I need to have some subject matter expertise. I need to know what I'm talking about. And I had to have enough expertise so that other experts could recognize that I knew what I was talking about, right? I wanted to get some teaching experience in me so I knew I could figure out how to communicate these ideas in an engaging way so they can be understood. And I needed to develop some skill in communicating through some kind of technological medium, right? Designed for public consumption. So not the same thing as face-to-face lecturing or writing for academic journals, something like what we could now think about as videos or podcasts or so on. So I figured I could develop those skills in academia. And so I had this project of getting a PhD and becoming a professor. And I was a science philosophy nerd, the sort of combination of which was perfect for me. So I studied philosophy of science in grad school. And I loved teaching and I loved academic life, right? But I always knew that this was going to be a chapter and I was going to close the door on that chapter at some point. And my initial plan was to be only an academic for like 10 years and then transfer somehow. It turned out that it's a harder thing to do. So the courage part is certainly there, because once I was in it for 10 years, we had two kids and a family and a mortgage and all those things. And the transition from a salaried academic to a self-employed online educator is much harder than I imagined. It's also much more fun than I had imagined. It's more fulfilling for sure, but it's also much harder and scarier as well.
Yeah, the security factor is really different. And I do want to remind our listeners that we're talking to Dr. Kevin De La Plante, who, as he just expressed, is privatized himself and gone on the road with the media road, that is, with critical thinking and bringing that. And I want to talk a little bit about your development in terms of your thinking about critical thinking. And
sure.
We talked about the Critical Thinker Academy. Let's move to the Argument Ninja Academy, because that's kind of a different thing. In that, as I've read about it and listened to some of the podcasts on it, you certainly are going to teach the logical reasoning, the basics, and you're also going to talk about what we've learned from cognitive sciences about our cognitive vulnerabilities. That is kind of within the realm of what we've been doing in this show and some other people beginning to do in their podcasts and books they're writing and that kind of thing. But you've added another dimension in this Ninja Academy, Argument Ninja Academy, and that is to include a focus on the field of persuasion. And that's an area that's not usually considered a part of critical thinking. So can you talk a little bit about what brought you to that approach?
Yeah, well, that's exactly right. So what got me to there was teaching this material for a long time, and then coming to realize that the textbooks weren't including material, for example, on cognitive biases. So I had to go elsewhere outside of the standard critical thinking textbooks to bring in material on confirmation bias or cognitive dissonance or framing effects or whatnot. The whole field of the psychology of human judgment and reason that started with Kahneman and Tversky and sort of has grown for 45 years, right? Mm-hmm. That developed alongside, in parallel to what's called the critical thinking education movement in the U.S. So, which was, you know, this movement to frame critical thinking skills as part of the goals of education. And there was a lobbying effort, and it was mostly that was kind of motivated by like 60s radicals in the university system who were really frustrated with, you know, the civil rights movement, the war, the women's rights movement, all these sort of socially contentious upheavals going on in society. And their students weren't learning skills to be able to engage argumentatively on those kinds of real world topics. I mean, you could study formal logic, but formal logic wasn't really all that useful. And so that gave rise to the birth of the informal reasoning movement, the informal logic movement, and eventually this reform movement in education called the critical thinking education movement, which really took hold in California in the 1970s and 80s. And that led to the passing of the Critical Thinking Education Act, or whatever it was called, which required critical thinking course in all of the California state schools back in 1980.
The community colleges. I was working in the community college at that time, and they actually implemented critical thinking in all the classes. So all the course descriptions had to be rewritten.
Right. Right. So it was a major win for that movement. But, you know, the textbooks were written by philosophers, largely. And they were assembled based on material that philosophers were familiar with from their education in formal logic, informal logic, and so forth. And so, you know, fallacy theory and so on. So the textbooks were structured in a certain way, and there was a common template for them. And the psychological stuff just didn't appear, right? So, and that reflects a sort of longstanding, you know, disengagement with rhetoric and persuasion that philosophy has had since the time of the Greeks, frankly. So argumentation as a type of rhetoric was, you know, part of Greek and Aristotle is sort of born there, but it sort of split off back then, and it was carried on. So people who studied English and rhetoric and communication science, for example, or studies could study argumentation as a form of social persuasion and all those rhetorical forms, for example, and speech and oratory. But argumentation as a sort of tool for the pursuit of philosophical wisdom and truth, right? Argumentation, like what counts as a good reason to believe X, was taken up by philosophers, scientists, mathematicians, and so on. And in that domain, the emphasis on persuasion and the social, psychological aspects was viewed as corrosive. It was viewed as tainting, as kind of contaminating what should be a more pure discipline. And that view that a focus on persuasion is somehow contaminating something that ought to be kept pure persists through this day, so that I can do a PhD in philosophy and learn nothing about rhetoric. And people in English programs can learn rhetoric and learn no logic at all, right? It's like it's divided. And that, and what I saw in the classroom and in the work is that this division has handicapped critical thinking education for decades. We have two different ways in which we get schooled in these things. We have philosophy and maybe academia and science, where we learn principles of good reasoning. And if you want to learn about social persuasion and psychology, you get to learn, you need to learn marketing and whatever, and you get, you know, you can learn how to sell, and you can learn how to get people to like you, and it's a whole other field, and they don't mix. But what I came to believe, to realize is that the skills that we were teaching students in the classroom did not transfer outside the classroom into the public domain. Namely, if you learn how to reason persuasively within the confines, within this, by you following sort of standard good rules of reasoning, and you try that on your parents, or try that in your office, or try that with your friends, you'll get slapped down, right? Mm-hmm. Human nature doesn't respond in that way. If you go in thinking that people will respond in the way you were trained to respond in class, like distinguish the person from the argument, don't take this personally, be willing to have your views challenged, for example, that's a good thing, not a bad thing, right? It's not a threatening thing. But in the real world, you have all these psychological mechanisms, natural forces that make people resist that kind of thing. In fact, you can annoy people horribly if you speak to them in the way that you're taught to speak in a philosophy class. So I thought we really need to make, we're not doing the students a good service here by giving them, by not teaching them about the real world, about how the real world works. And who knows the real world better than the people who live in the real world, make their living in the real world, the salesmen, the con artists, the advertisers, the speech writers, the spokespeople, the magicians. Their knowledge of human psychology, their applied knowledge, is vast and powerful. And I thought, what if you combined that knowledge with the kind of traditional rigorous knowledge of logic and critical thinking and so forth, that is the critical thinking ideals that I was just mentioning. If you take someone who has internalized those critical thinking goals and understands how human psychology actually works, wouldn't that be a much more powerful combination? But that's the motivation for the argument ninja.
But there's more than just understanding, because if I understand what you've said in some of the podcasts, that a person who is training to be an argument ninja needs to be prepared to use tactics that maybe marketers, advertisers, persuaders in general use, not just in self-defense, but in offense, in promoting their argument in an offensive, I don't mean offensive.
You mean way. In an attempt to persuade other people.
Exactly. In an attempt to persuade. I have to admit, there's a part of me that is still working this through, this idea, mm-hmm. because I live in a liberal progressive area, and I am much more critical of people that I agree with when they begin to spin the argument and exaggerate or leave out key information and stuff like that. It's really annoying to me, because I still labor under this impression that a good argument doesn't need to be spun. It can, it sells itself. Right. And so, and I'm not saying that I totally believe that, but that's kind of where my philosophical evolution is going. So I had wondered, you know, and wanted to ask you this question because I think you're several steps ahead of me.
Well, it's a big topic. I will say this. If you want to have me back on to talk about the ethics of persuasion, I should. I would love to do that because it's one of the issues that I get pushback on from some of my fans as well who want me to say more about this. But I will say that your instinct to feel uncomfortable about that means that you're on the right track. That is, you should feel uncomfortable about it. That's a sign that you understand something about what's at stake here. About manipulation and coercion.
Well, I think I'm going to have to take you up on that offer to have you back because we're at almost 7:45 and we do want to open the phone lines. And we've gotten through about half of the questions.
Not even that.
And some of them are kind of advanced intricacies of critical thinking that I really wanted to get your information about. So let's go ahead and open the phone lines. If we don't get any callers, then we will we'll continue with the discussion. We have a number more questions, but let's go to the next question then.
Okay. I'm intently listening. I'm sure our listeners are too. I was kind of curious on your course series on cognitive biases, something we've discussed here before, Thinking Clearly. You get into de-biasing strategies. Could you talk about this concept and give us some examples of how we can work around our biases and the biases of others in a way that assists our critical thinking? Because it's one of those sort of human condition elements that obviously we need to work with when we're communicating with folks.
Yeah, no, I think it's the most important. Unfortunately, this doesn't get enough attention in the psychological resources, actually. So it's really great that people are now becoming aware of the literature on cognitive biases. I mean, popular books on this have really done a great job, I think, of spreading this around. And now people are familiar with confirmation bias and other sorts of, you know, well-known terms now. It's easy to get like a pessimistic sense that we're so hardwired to think poorly, that our intuitive responses are, triggered to make, you know, systematic errors in certain kind of environments that. And they have the kind of feature of an illusion in the sense that even if I am aware that I'm misjudging here, it's very difficult for me to force myself to not make the judgment. So what do you do? Well, there is a literature on debiasing, which is, you know, any kind of strategy you can use that tries to mitigate or prevent or lessen the negative impacts of cognitive biases is a debiasing strategy. There are two categories of them. I kind of mentioned them indirectly. So if you have, you can try to do things like where you modify the person. So I can teach you, for example, teaching people about cognitive biases has a sort of a consciousness raising effect, and that can be effective in making people aware. So that's one strategy, is consciousness raising about the existence of these biases and how we're all prone to them. We're not exceptions to this rule. But there's also this literature on simple cognitive hacks, essentially, you can do that help. For example, you know, one of the ways in which these biases work is by narrowing the focus of our attention. So it's like a spotlight effect. You have a street light, and the cone of light illuminates a patch below on the road at nighttime. And that's sort of the effect of these biases, where the heuristic or the rule of thumb that our brain is using to try to make sense of the world or process information is, you know, the world has all kinds of information in it. And our knowledge, our background knowledge has all kinds of information in it. But we have to quickly act and make judgments decisions. And that means we have to automatically narrow the focus of attention and then trigger some behavioral scripts or some, you know, perceptual scripts that will do the job that our brain and evolution and adaptation, whatever, have believed will do a good enough job for us. So one way in which you can counteract those effects is find ways of broadening the scope of our attention, of widening the domain of information that we pay attention to. And a simple thing like asking you to consider ways in which you might be wrong. Like there's a strategy called consider the opposite, where you have to list three or four or five ways in which your assumption about X could be wrong. And that conscious activity automatically has a way of undermining the narrow focusing effect of something like confirmation bias. Mm-hmm. And there's all kinds of strategies like this.
That's very, very, very helpful. And we do have a caller, but I do want to point out and point our listeners to your website, because you do have a whole episode on debiasing strategies, right?
The website, I've got a course. Like, so I've got a course yeah. on cognitive biases, of which there's a whole section on debiasing.
A whole section. So they can view that on Critical Thinker Academy.
That's at Critical Thinker Academy.
Yeah,
right.
And we have that link to our Facebook page, but it's just criticalthinkeracademy.com, one word, no periods in between those words, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's welcome our caller to Thinking Clearly. Welcome. You're on the line.
Hello, caller.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Do you have a question for our guest?
I'm wondering if there's any recommendations about not necessarily a favorite philosopher, but maybe a philosopher that brings something important to the table that's relevant to the topic.
Sure, that's a great question. You have a little insomnia? You're looking for some primary source reading at night?
Yeah, that would be great.
Well, I can recommend Kevin De LaPlante as a philosopher, but maybe Kevin can recommend a second choice.
Can I ask you, caller, if there's a specific kind of topic or an issue that's kind of bugging you that you would like to, you know, have a different perspective on, or be able to have some resource is offered to you? Is it How would you like it to be applied?
Lately I'm concerned about, something along the lines of the ethics of persuading the other in sort of a philosophical sense, maybe persuasion is not.
I'm hearing that you're interested in arguing in the philosophic sense with other people. You mentioned ethics. Are you curious about where the sort of line is as far as how you use rhetoric and manipulation? I don't want to put words in your mouth. Okay. We're just trying to get to the core of what your inquiry is.
Like an interesting article that popped up recently was, okay, where's the line when you're talking to people on the extremes of the far right? What's the ethics behind having a dialogue versus maybe not having a dialogue? Is there a line that gets crossed in there ethically, or are there any philosophers that explore that concept?
So I think I see the focus of your interest here. I wish I could say there are more philosophers who are writing about the sort of current political environment we're in, and about communication strategies that are, you know, better or worse. But there's some. I think if I had a reading list, I would say I would always recommend Jonathan Haidt's book, The Righteous Mind. He's a psychologist. He's a social psychologist. But his work on the psychology of these basic kind of moral values that people have, this diversity of what he has, like he identifies six different categories or types of moral values that seem to be dominate differently in the mindset of liberals versus conservatives, and often the religious conservatives have a certain profile in terms of the kind of values that matter to them. And the book is very interesting, but it also gives you a lot of interesting tools for how to communicate across the aisle, because one simple persuasion strategy could be something like if you knew that the person you were talking to was motivated by a certain kind of value system, then if you can reframe your point in a way that speaks to their value system, then that's more likely to be receptive to it, and so on. And there are some books on that are talking about the value of philosophical argumentation in liberal democratic societies. There's a book called Why We Argue, which is about a kind of a defense of the value of rational argumentation for the in the service of liberal democratic political goals. But the practical problem of how we communicate in this sort of highly polarized tribal culture we're in right now is a different matter. And frankly, I think the more you get your hands dirty in terms of the psychology of understanding the roots of sort of tribal identity conflict, then the better equipped you are to develop communication strategies to be effective.
And thank you, caller, for that question. And I want to mention that you spell Haidt, H-A-I-D-T, and that book is in our Humboldt County Library system. I checked it out about 2 weeks ago, and then I bought a copy and just got my copy today. But you can get that. You don't have to buy it. You can just go to the library or order it. And I don't know where you are, whatever library you're close to, you can request it and they'll send it to you. What's the full title of that again, Kevin?
The full title is The Righteous Mind, How Politics and Religion.
The Righteous Mind. That's all you need. Jonathan.
The Righteous Mind is the one there. Yeah. And there's a handful of others. I mean,
I'll put some suggested reading for this question on our Facebook page. So let's go to the next caller. Welcome to Thinking Clearly.
I think this will be our last caller for the evening. Hello, caller. Do you have a question?
Yes, I do. Yeah. Earlier, the issue was brought up about how difficult it is for people to think critically with the prevalence of disinformation on the internet. You know, a lot of people obviously rely on Google searches for their information, and you know, the things that come to the top of Google searches are the things that get the most hits on the internet. And just because a website gets the most hits doesn't mean it's the best source of information.
Mm-hmm.
So considering like fake news, for instance, how do we counteract all this disinformation and propaganda on the internet that apparently is convincing millions of Americans of things that are clearly ridiculous?
Mm-hmm.
Great question,
mm-hmm.
caller. Thank you. Do you have any insights for us to battle this simple little problem we have?
Well, there's been two strategies, I think, there's been a capitulation strategy. So if the left, for example, thinks that the right has dominated the framing of issues through the language they use or the rhetoric or disinformation, then there's a school of thought that says you have to learn to fight fire with fire and try to counter program the message by using the very same tactics. Lakoff, for example, George Lakoff has a kind of a line like this, where he wants to teach liberals how to frame issues in a way that exploits the same kind of psychological rhetorical mechanisms that the conservatives have been doing so well for decades. But I think that's a race to the bottom, right? that doesn't solve the problem. I think what you need is a reinvestment in social and cultural institutions and norms that support the kind of critical thinking values and goals that we were talking about earlier in the program. Now, those tend to be only upheld, we see them in classrooms and academia. We see it in scientific institutions. We see it in the judicial system, where there's certain norms of how decisions are made that follow sort of protocols of reason. And in the public square, the public domain, those have much less of a purchase, right? So we're much more, we don't have norms like that constrain our thinking. And left on our own, we are very much vulnerable, I think, unless the way to tribal sort of thinking and very, very hard to turn around beliefs that get entangled with those identities, for example.
And we can probably continue this. If I will take you up on your offer to have you back sometime, and I'll keep in touch because there's so much more important stuff out there. And we're right at the top of the hour. Can you, Kevin, give your contact information, how people can get a hold of your courses that you teach and help support your...
Become a ninja themselves.
Yeah.
Become a ninja. Yeah. I didn't talk that much about the Argument Ninja podcast or the program because of, you know, time, whatnot. But so there's the criticalthinkeracademy.com, which is the tutorial site. There's argumentninja.com, which is the home of the Argument Ninja podcast, which I've been doing for about a year, which has lots of content on it now. And then and out of there, there's kevindelaplante.com, which is my personal hub site where you can contact me about speaking engagements and consulting work, which is also part of the things I do. And you can get on the email list, actually, too, so if you want to hear about updates to the Critical Thinker program, or I should say the Argument Ninja Academy program, which is a kind of next generation online learning platform.
Which is great. I hope people take the opportunity to subscribe to your podcast, Become an Argument Ninja, as well as subscribe to Thinking Clearly Radio.
Believe me, folks, this is cutting edge stuff. And you spell Kevin's last name, D-E, capital L-A-P-L-A-N-T-E. And we'll put this on our Facebook page. And I want to thank you very much, Kevin, for coming on the show here, Thinking Clearly. And Dr. Kevin DeLaplante is a private independent educator now, a speaker consultant specializing in critical thinking skills. So thank you very much, Kevin.
Thank you, Bob. And thank you, Julia.
Yourself, little man. Don't let them tell you that they have the plan. 'Cause everyone's lost, chin deep in the sand. And what they're trying to sell to you, you shouldn't be buying. Think for yourself, little girl. Don't let them tell.
This program was produced in KMUD's Red Way Studios and is provided courtesy of KMUD, People Powered Radio.